Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley. And our guest today is Roy R. Behrens. Until his retirement from teaching in 2018, Roy was professor and distinguished scholar at the University of Northern Iowa. He taught graphic design, illustration, and design history at UNI and other universities and art schools for more than 45 years, which kind of explains the focus on graphic artists in this book that we're talking about. He's the author of 7 books and literally hundreds of articles, and has appeared in broadcast interviews on Nova, NPR, and Australian Public Radio, BBC, etc., etc. He was nominated for the National Design Awards, received the Iowa Board of Regents Faculty Excellence Award, and has been described as one of the most original thinkers in design. And the book that we're talking about today is Dreams of Fields, Memory Traces of Iowa's Past. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Roy.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So are you a native Iowan?
I am. I spent about my first 17 or 20 years here or something like that. Actually went to undergraduate school at Cedar Falls.
Okay.
And what little
Iowa town did you grow up in?
Well, it's a county seat, Independence.
Okay.
So it's not quite as small as it might be.
Well, the timing of this interview is really interesting because yesterday my sister and I took my mother, who is 90, to visit her hometown in Newton, Iowa.
Oh.
And she wanted to she's been going there almost every year for her class reunion. She lives in Mount Pleasant now, but mm-hmm. she's didn't have the opportunity to kind of visit the places that she normally likes to go see this year, and she's not sure if she'll be able to make it next year. So she wanted that opportunity. And so we visited, we drove by the church where she got married, and we drove by what used to be the high school, but is now a public library, a brand new building, but the old high school.
Yeah.
Her class was the first class to graduate from the new high school, which is now not that new since that was 1953. So she spent her senior year at the new high school. What else? And we went by, of course, the house that she grew up in, which is just a lovely place, and the old Hotel Maytag.
Mm-hmm.
And and the cemetery. So where, generations of family have been buried. So it does bring to me a lot of memory traces of Iowa's past.
Yes, I remember I spoke in Newton one time. I've been aware of the town for a long time, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and the Maytag Park. We went to the Fred Maytag Park. My grandmother was very good friends with Mrs. Maytag, and so my mother has a lot of memories of the Maytags there.
Yeah.
So, and also we saw my grandfather's, where his law office was on the square.
Wow.
So, so what inspired you to write this book, and what is it exactly?
Well, I did a recount a couple of days ago, and I actually published 10 books. I didn't realize it.
Oh, my goodness. You lost track.
Yeah. I don't know what happened. But so most of the books that I published are about graphic design, design history, illustration. Only 3 of the books have been about Iowa. And, one of them was about Frank Lloyd Wright's buildings in Mason City, which I'm sure you're aware of.
Well, yes, because my company has a factory in Mason City, so I get up there periodically, and I've stayed at the Historic Park Inn. It's very charming.
Oh, it's really something, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. It is.
And the other one that I did, which no one seems to know about, is that there was a painter in the early part of the 20th century from my hometown who was an expatriate. He left and lived most of his life in Paris and Mallorca, but he was a very, very close long-term friend of Gertrude Stein. And his other claim to fame is that when his father died in Independence, a lawyer, he used his inheritance to hire the unknown architect Le Corbusier to design his home on the outskirts of Paris. And that's called Maison Cook or Villa Cook. And the guy's name was William Edwards Cook. And so my book about his life is called Cook Book.
How cute yeah. is that?
Yeah. So, but what I wanted to say with regard to this book is that I've been writing essays about Iowa. I can't remember when I started. It's been a long time, at least 50 years, and publishing them. And I have lots. And but in this book, there are 25 of them. And I probably have, maybe twice more, you know, that I could have used. But there are things, I mean, why am I so interested in Iowa? Well, it's simply the fact that I grew up here and I have memories like your memories, you know, of Newton. I have a kind of idealized, dreamlike notion of Iowa. I think it's very false, probably, but I probably made a lot of stuff up in my mind. And like a lot of people, I'm not very happy with what has happened to it in terms of environment and health.
We've got some issues, yeah. don't we?
Yeah. So
water this is quality, kind of, let me just say, water quality is so important, and it's being ignored by the people who shouldn't, who are in power. Okay, I'm done.
Yeah. You know, well, I live on an acreage. I'm surrounded by poisons, and you know. Anyway, so what I wanted to write about in my essays nearly always are unknown people, or virtually unknown people from Iowa, and that's really what I've dug up. You know, for example, if I can just give you one, in World War I, one of the artists. Who started the American Camouflage Corps, because camouflage and art are very much related, was a man from Iowa. He was born in Creston, and we know him. People know him, actually, because when they go to Oskaloosa and go to the town square, there's a statue of Chief Mahaska there. And if you look at the base, it says, it's signed, S. Fry. And the man was Sherry Edmondson Fry. And he was actually one of the best known young sculptors at the time in the early part of the 20th century. And anyway, he got very interested in camouflage because hundreds of others artists were as well. And so and most people don't know that. They don't know anything about him. Well, they might know the Mahaska sculpture, but that's it. So I've, unearthed his life. Over the years, along with so many other people, you know.
Right, right. And some of these essays aren't necessarily about Iowans, but they're about people who had some connection with Iowa in some way. And then sometimes it was not a really huge connection, like Dali, Salvador Dali.
Yeah. Well, it was a huge collection for a day or two.
Yeah, for a day or two. You want to tell us about Salvador Dali visiting Cedar Falls?
I learned about it because I went to school at UNI in Cedar Falls, and on the faculty at that time were some of the older faculty who had actually been at the party. And they told me, and then I afterwards wrote to some of those who had retired and moved away, and they sent me letters of their memories of that evening, which was pretty spectacular. I mean, hilariously so. He was invited to come by, I think it was called the Controversial Speakers Committee or something like that. And Edward R. Murrow was actually invited first. And he was, you know, quite popular and in demand. And at the last minute, he said he couldn't come. So they looked for a speaker's bureau, and they found out that Dali was available because he wanted to go on a like, I think it was a 10-lecture tour, you know, west of the Mississippi. And it happened to be that Cedar Falls was the first one.
Oh, my.
And I tell this story. I mean, I went to a lot of effort to find eyewitnesses. And, there were some funny moments that everyone, I think, will enjoy.
Oh, yeah.
So he's on the cover.
Yes, that and a picture of Fields with, was that a tractor? Like a, yeah, describe the cover to me a little more.
Jeez, where is it?
There's some very old-fashioned cars, and I think maybe a tractor or maybe the original combine.
Yeah, some kind of farm machinery. But the thing that I was trying to emphasize was the perspective was the flatness that we ascribe to Iowa. And of course, then that connects to prairie school architecture and the notion of we associate flatness with Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture and the kind of tabletop, elongated surfaces.
Yeah. Well, when we were driving to Newton yesterday, that was something we were talking about, was how my mother always, whenever we take her out in the country like that, she'll always make a comment about how far you can see.
Oh. Yes.
And why, because of that, why that central Iowa, you know, so good for growing corn and soybeans, because it's so level and just goes on forever. You know, while we were talking, I Googled Maison Cook, and I am amazed at how modern that looks. It was built in 1926, but it looks like it could have been, I thought mid-century modern was a little later than that, but apparently not, because this is so modern. Wow.
Well, it was an early one for Corbusier. It was his first so-called Cubist-styled house. But modernism, actually, we probably associate with the Bauhaus, which started in 1919. So it was right around the same time.
Right, right. There was that amazing movie recently about that.
There was?
Yeah, that Adrian Brody was starred in. I'll think of it eventually. The Brutalist.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It was a boxing film?
No, it was an architecture film.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. The style of Brutalist.
Yeah. And very, very interesting. If you haven't seen that, I recommend that.
I will look for it.
Yeah, take a look at that. So how did you decide which essays? Well, first, I guess the first question is that when you were putting together this book, were some of these essays that you had written in the past, or did you write them all for the book?
No, they were all from the past.
Okay.
I don't think I've wrote some of them very recently, last year or two. But, there are really a couple of categories. One is that I was wanting to write about people who were born here and who are largely unknown, but whose accomplishments are worth spotlighting. And what I didn't want to do was to write about the ones that most people already know about: Johnny Carson, Glenn Miller, Donna Reed. Or, you know, usually it's sports heroes or politicians or, it's Field of Dreams. And whereas I wanted to do Dreams of Fields, because that's a pretty good description of my memories of Iowa and the way I think about it.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I also wanted to write, as you were indicating before, I wanted to write about people who were not from Iowa, you know, but they have some connection because they were here, like Dolly briefly, or Mark Twain had a connection, but it wasn't tremendous. Buffalo Bill has connections to everything, it seems. You know, I used to go around lecturing on these topics for the Humanities Iowa Speakers Bureau. And I swear, every little town I went to, when I talked about Buffalo Bill, somebody would come out of the audience and say, "Oh, yeah, my great grandfather, he was a good friend of Bill's."
Well, my great grandfather wrote a letter to Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain. Because my family's name was Clements with a T, and he wrote to see if there might be, you know, there might be some relation further back, but the T got dropped at some point, and I think there was always some indication that that might have been the case, and that the Clemens and the Clements might be related.
Now, wasn't the guy who wrote the night before Christmas, wasn't his name Clements with a T?
I think so. I think that's true. And so that could be a relation too. Hard to tell. And the Clements did come to Iowa in the 1800s.
Yeah.
The mid 1800s, and I have a lot of family history. You know, old letters, old newspaper clippings. Yeah. My great-great-grandfather was a judge in central Iowa, and I have a newspaper clipping that talks about him as the only honest judge in Iowa.
Gee. Must not have been much of a competition.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell.
I mean, but, to be honest.
Yeah, really. Iowa does have, there's a lot of interesting history. It was a very progressive state in a lot of ways for many, many years.
Yes. Yeah. I remember that. Yeah. Yes, that's how I thought of it. I was always proud of it because I lived all over the country during the 45 years that I taught and after I left Iowa. And I was always proud to say I was from Iowa because, you know, some of our congressmen were some of the most respected people in the country. I mean, really. Yeah. And there were things that we did in education that were, you know, internationally known. Iowa City and some of the people who were on the faculty there and,
oh yeah,
you know, their status in various fields.
And also just we were one of the lesser racist states in those early years. Like, for example, George Washington Carver was accepted as a student at Iowa State University, where he couldn't go to a lot of places. And I think we were one of the first states that allowed African-American teachers and interracial marriage and things like that. And also were very important stop on the Underground Railroads.
Yes.
There are very important stops on the Underground Railroad here, including one run by my great-grandparents.
And, really?
Yeah, in Lambs Grove, Iowa. And so there was a lot to be proud of.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I think it made it even more special because people initially thought that Iowa was backward and it's in the middle of the heart of the Midwest. And just to think that look, it's actually progressive.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And you know, the farmers were very progressive.
Yes.
And, you know, the Grange, I don't know that much about it, but it was a you probably know more about the Grange than I do, but I feel like that was a progressive movement of farmers.
Yeah. Yeah. Henry Wallace. I mean, to think how important he was in agriculture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And had another thought, which is now escaping me, so maybe I'll get it back later. So anyway, when you sat down to put this book together, how did you decide what went in it?
Well, I kind of started with those two categories. And then the other thing that I added, which may not be as apparent, is that I ended up including two stories about my family. I didn't want to do some kind of memoir thing. That's not what I want to do. But you know, my father grew up in Winnipeg County. My great grandparents had come from Germany as farmers, and they ended up in Gutenberg, and then they moved northward to Winnipeg County, which is near Decorah, Postville, places like that. And my father grew up on a farm there. He had six brothers and sisters. And my grandfather was helping someone in the field one day, and this was in 1919, the Industrial Revolution, machinery was weird, and his clothing was caught in a threshing machine, and so he was tragically and awfully, you know, died in a half hour. But the thing is that they had had all sorts of bad crops and bad weather, and so suddenly my grandmother is left with her seven children and no place to live. They lost a farm, no income. And so I don't know if you know, if you're familiar with up there, but there's an old fort up there, army fort called Fort Atkinson, and there's a town there called Fort Atkinson, and the ruins of the fort were privately owned at that time. And so my father and his mother and all his brothers and sisters had to move into the ruins of the fort for a year. And so I tell the story of that, which is quite interesting. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that there's another essay in which I don't necessarily say that it was my family, but they were from Manchester, Iowa. And the three of my great aunts ended up moving to New Mexico with husbands, two of which were from Manchester, and they became trading post owners on the Navajo reservation. They lived with the Navajo for 30 years.
Oh my!
And there's a town down there on the reservation named after them, and they wrote all sorts of books. And one of them was considered to be one of the top specialists on Navajo sand painting. So I've never met them, but they would send me little things like Kachina dolls and whatever, you know. And now that their children and grandchildren are old, I communicate with them all the time now, and they send me all their photos. And so I wrote about that, you know, in one of the essays.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about sand painting. I, you know, would not have known there was an Iowa connection with sand painting. Don't really know much about that sand painting at all.
Well, not much was known about it until my relatives began to not only write about it, but prior to that time, it couldn't be shown because it was sacred. And it was always done inside a hogan that was not open to non-Navajo. And the wife of one of the men from Manchester convinced the Navajo to let her sit in, but she couldn't say anything. She couldn't record anything or photograph anything. And then gradually she became trusted. And what she would do is she would sit in, but she would memorize every aspect of the sand painting design and then redraw it once she got out. And then she later convinced one of the Navajos to start transforming those into weavings. And so that's how we know about sand painting. The ritual is far too complex to talk about, but
wow. Yeah. But then there's the other type of sand painting in a bottle. And
that's
now
right.
We're back to the Clemens again.
Yes, we are.
The Clemens without a T.
And we're back to the Mississippi.
Yeah.
Because it took place in McGregor. Yeah. And there was a fellow named Clemens. who was a deaf, a mute, as they would say at the time. And so he spent his life in McGregor. There were colored sands on the riverbanks there. And he would collect this colored sands and then Oh, painstakingly put them in these bottles, very tightly packed, and corked them up. And they are these beautiful, beautiful, highly detailed colored bottle paintings, if you want to call them that.
And you wrote that he had made hundreds of them, but there's few have survived.
Yeah, I think so, because if they broke, it's gone.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he dropped them.
Yeah.
If they weren't tightly packed for some reason, and if, let's say, they got shaken or something, then that would destroy the design.
Yeah.
And there were also imitators whose work was awful. I've seen that, you know, but it's very difficult to do.
I bet. And I bet there's somebody out there who has one of these, has no idea that it could be worth a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, it was on American Roadshow. There was one of them. I forget, maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And everybody was shocked at the value.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I think the value has gone up, you know, for those.
Now, one of the essays is about people leaving Iowa on covered wagons for the gold rush. Were there a lot of Iowans who went west? For that?
Oh, heavens, yes. And for some reason, Tipton, Iowa was a gathering place for people from the East Coast to gather in Iowa at Tipton, and then they would kind of organize their wagon trains there, because it was very important to travel together. Dangerous, easy to get lost, all sorts of things could happen. And I write about a woman who survived all of that and then wrote about it and, you know, described it. I'm trying to think here. I forget her first name, but the thing that's so startling is it turns out that she was the mother of a very famous philosopher at Harvard, Josiah Royce. Yeah. And he's the one who convinced her to tell the story of traveling from Tipton, you know, and then to Iowa City. It took them 2 days to get to Iowa City, and they're trying to get to California. And then they got to Des Moines, and then when they got to Council Bluffs, they had to wait because there were so many wagons wanting to be transported across the river there. Oh, such stories, I'll tell you. And she almost, they were almost lost, because she was very religious and she refused to travel on Sundays. Now, here they are, they're in this wagon train and she's refusing to travel on Sunday. Well, it doesn't take long for pretty soon they're all alone.
Yeah.
And they think they're following everybody, but they're going at night also because it's so hot. And they take the wrong turn, which other people have taken before, and they start finding skeletons and other remains and realize, oh my gosh, we shouldn't have done that. And so they turn back and they just barely make it before they couldn't cross the mountains anymore. Yeah.
You know, this reminds me, one thing I didn't see in here was a chapter about the Mormon trek through Iowa.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife was just in Nauvoo recently, and
yeah,
was telling me about what is there. Yeah, and I've been reading about some of that.
Because they came through the farm of one of my ancestors, and I have some stories that someone mm-hmm. wrote down about them coming through there.
Yeah, I think if you look at an Iowa state road map, they have the Mormon Trail.
Yeah.
Follow across the state, you know.
Well, Roy, why don't you read a little bit for us from Dreams of Fields, Memory Traces mm-hmm. of Iowa's Past? And then I think you had another piece that's not in here that you wanted to share with us, too.
Yeah, they're both short. And I think what I'll do is I'll start out by reading what is the introduction or preface or whatever or part of it, whatever, to the book itself. And I think that will explain a lot about, you know, the nature of the book. And so it goes like this. In Thomas Wolfe's famous novel, You Can't Go Home Again, the main character, a novelist like Wolfe, concludes, quote, "You can't go back home to your family, back home to your childhood, back home to the old forms and systems of things which once seemed everlasting, but which are changing all the time," unquote. Years later, it may have been artist Larry Rivers who said, "Well, you can go home again, but you can't stay longer than 45 minutes. I was born in Iowa. I was born in Iowa. I lived there continuously for 17 years. As Iowa native Jake Johansson said, it took a long time for me to realize that we were free to go." I could have claimed that I was born in rural Iowa, but when I was growing up, all of Iowa was rural, or at least it wasn't urban, and the pace of change was dreadfully slow. My departure was as painful as it was inevitable. It was painful because, as Helen Hayes explained, every one of us is, quote, "born with the tragedy that he has to grow up, that he has to leave the nest, the security, and go out to do battle. He has to lose everything that is lovely and fight for a new loveliness of his own making, and it's a tragedy. A lot of people don't have the courage to do it," unquote. It was also inevitable. I sensed that if I did not leave, my dreams would start to ossify. I would surely be overwhelmed by complacency and convenience, and my zeal to live life fully would soon begin to falter. I was reminded of that a few years ago when I read Bruce Kellner's account of how Carl Van Vechten escaped from the Iowa town, Cedar Rapids, in which he grew up. Van Vechten's birthplace, according to Kellner, quote, was like one of Iowa's customary midday meals, wholesome and plentiful, unimaginably but well-cooked, on which one might grow. But to stick around for second helpings could induce indigestion. The Corn Belt had a way of stealthily tightening around the belly, unquote. So as Kellner concluded, Van Vechten, quote, was born in Iowa, but he got out as soon as possible. I have to wonder, did Carl Van Vechten ever look back? We know that Grant Wood certainly did. He left the American Midwest in quest of something greater than the vast cornfields in which he had been quarantined. But with much the same disillusion he felt when he initially fled, he turned his back on Europe and came home to view his surroundings anew through a modified filter with a tint of intrigue and rich detail that he had only seen abroad before. Some of his best ideas, he said, came to me while I was milking a cow. In the years that followed my own escape, I was fortunate to live temporarily in a bewildering sequence of places, among them California, Colorado, Hawaii, Rhode Island, Wisconsin, Georgia, and Ohio. Each place had its treachery, but each was also a source of mystique. At age 45, when I returned to live in Iowa, it's not that I reversed my course. Instead, I came back as an emigre with a crazy quilt of adjacent yet exotic lands, entrenched still intact pockets of the great American melting pot, outposts that had yet to melt. But like Grant Wood, I returned with a new set of lenses by which the too familiar surrounds were once again open to exploration, as it was when I was young, growing up in Iowa. A friend of mine once said of someone whom he believed to be shallow, that if you scratch his surface, you will only come out on the opposite side. For many people, their lasting impression of Iowa is that it is all too dreadfully shallow, despite its boast of deep, rich soil. It is, as is commonly noted, the flyover state, a region where flat earth believers could thrive, a land where, as Iowa-born writer Bill Bryson once said, if you stand on two telephone books, you can see forever. I had discovered a wondrous approach, as is exemplified by the stories in this book. The simple solution I found was to dig below appearances to unearth the surface wherever I stand. The essays here are evidence of the rich remains that one can find by recalling Iowa's peopled past, by searching for its arrowheads. They are not fields of dreams as such, but rather more like dreams of fields. And what better dreams could one hope for than those that restore the achievements of remarkable characters from the past who were born in Iowa, or who lived here, or who maybe just stopped by to talk? I conclude with a favorite story. In the early 1990s, the New York mobster, Salvatore Sammy the Bull Gravano, agreed to cooperate with the FBI in prosecuting mob boss John Gotti and other members of the Gambino family. An initial meeting was arranged between Gravano and an Iowa-born FBI agent named Bruce Mao. As told in Underboss, a book by Peter Moss, the meeting began in the following way. Quote, Bruce Mao walks over and shakes my hand, Gravano recalled. He opened the door and I got in. I told him, are you Mao? He says, yes. And I said, I heard you were from Iowa. He said that was right. And I said, well, if you got to trust somebody, it might as well be somebody from Iowa and off.
And that's Roy R. Behrens from Reading from Dreams of Fields, Memory Traces of Iowa's Past. Iowa, that's where the tall corn grows. Do you know what where the origination of that saying is?
Didn't it come from some kind of state song or something like that?
Probably.
I think it's in that song. I read the history of that. Yeah.
Okay, and now you had another piece that you wanted to share with us today.
Yeah, it's not in the book. Recently I was asked to do a self-interview for a publication in I said, yes, I do it. And then I said to them, well, you know, I used to be a ventriloquist. And what if I have my ventriloquist dummy interview me? So I did. But I wrote a book on, or an essay on ventriloquism, which isn't in the book. And I just want to read the ending portion of that. When I was in grade school, I was given a genuine ventriloquist dummy as a Christmas present from my parents. It was an economy model, which means he had a moving mouth, but no head or eye movement. Our showbiz stardom did not last. The two of us stopped performing after only a year or two. Today, almost 70 years later, I still have that dummy. He lives here with my wife and me, along with the dogs, the parrots, and the cat. However, his paint is irreparably damaged, and he hasn't spoken for years. Looking back, I suppose I was never impassioned about ventriloquism, but I do know that throughout my life, I've had an insatiable interest in all kinds and varieties of puzzles, illusions, and conundrums. Among them, ships in bottles, seahorses, camouflage, the man in the moon, riddles, distorted rooms, pictures that contain themselves, metaphors, puns, magic tricks, after images, mirages, anamorphic distortions, hand shadows, living plants that mimic stones, chameleons, stage illusions, distorted mirrors, giants and midgets, concrete poetry, logical paradoxes, Mexican jumping beans, constellations, mimes, shapes in clouds or oil pools, the northern lights, auctioneering, pen pals, chalk talks, rainbows, yodeling, Japanese finger trips, music boxes, bonsai trees, wishbones, dowsing rods, strip poker, sumo wrestlers, lava lamps, walking sticks, smoke signals, saddle sores, spinning tops, tree houses, cat's eye marbles, mohawk haircuts, wooden nickels, crazy quilts, that song in which the lyrics say, I was looking back to see if you were looking back to see if I was looking back to see if sand paintings in a jar, loco weed, flying squirrels, snow domes, weeping willow trees, all turtles, sea monkeys, x-ray specks, yo-yos, pogo sticks, juggling, dung beetles, tadpoles, Venus flytraps, wax lips, school paste, cotton candy, beach blanket bingo, pipe dreams, kaleidoscopes, and cricket cages. I also still remember the endless childhood hours I spent after listening repeatedly to Gene Autry's recording of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, trying to decide if Rudolph would, quote, go down in history or go down in his story. Even now, I have yet to determine the answer to that.
And those are a few of your favorite things.
Apparently. Or even more than a few.
Oh, more than a few. Absolutely. You know, there's a couple of kind of recurring themes in the essays in these books, or not even just themes, but recurring points, details. One of them is traveling speakers, which were such an important part of culture during a certain time period, and which really aren't now. We don't have that same. Yeah. We don't, you know, I mean, people do still travel around giving speeches, but it doesn't have the same kind of impact on culture that it did then. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'm interested in that in part because I grew up with it. It was still happening. Chautauqua was a program, a traveling program, nationwide. And it was very active here. And that was not in existence, I don't think, at least not actively when I was a child. But I am old enough that I saw chalk talks, if you can imagine. I don't know if you know those, but there, someone is on stage and he has a big chalkboard and he draws these progressively evolution-like images. And they start out maybe with a simple shape, and then he says some more stuff, and then he makes another line, and it becomes some other thing. It's like a metamorphosis.
Oh. At the time, they were, kind of have a vague recollection of that.
So the people, at least in Northeast Iowa, maybe throughout the state, who may remember it, was that there was a man at the UNI faculty, a theater department, called Herb Hake. And he did that. He still did chalk talks. And he actually did them on TV out of the back of his station wagon. And he did them about Iowa history. And so I'm fascinated by that. And I think that then as I got older, they were replaced to some extent by radio. Radio was terribly important to my life. That's probably where I got addicted to comedy. You know, I love radio comedy. That's probably how I got into ventriloquism. Although, you know, if you do it on radio, they can't tell whether you're moving.
Yeah. It's easy to be a ventriloquist on radio.
Apparently, that's what I'm told. You know, even if when you went to the movies, there were newsreels. Right. You know, and those were pretty peculiar too.
Yeah.
And you know, I didn't grow up with a TV. My parents were fairly low income, so we didn't have a TV. I think until I was maybe a senior in high school or something like that.
Well, you know, the speaking tour was very important in the publishing industry, because that is how a lot of authors actually made their money. It wasn't from selling books. It was from the speaking engagements.
Yeah.
And so we've kind of lost that as a way for to support writers.
Yeah. Well, if you think Oscar Wilde did that.
Mm-hmm. Mark Twain, of course.
Mark Twain, yeah. And I'm trying to think of some of the others. You know, the arts and craftsman. I'm getting old here. Albert Hubbard. I was just so surprised. I've known about him for a long time because I teach design history.
People who don't know who he is, why don't you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, he was from Illinois originally, and he's actually a soap salesman, but he did extremely well and became a millionaire. And the company moved to Buffalo, New York, and he founded an artist colony there, which became quite famous. And he began to publish books, and everyone bought them. He was like a philosopher. But anyway, the point is that before all of that success, he was actually traveling around a lot speaking, and Iowa was one of the first places that he came. It was the first time he crossed the Mississippi. You know, Emerson crossed the Mississippi to talk in Iowa towns. I was surprised at how many Iowa towns he had talked in. But there were times when he couldn't get across the Mississippi because there wasn't a bridge at that point. So when the water was frozen over a couple of times, he had to walk across the Mississippi. One time, it wasn't totally frozen, so they put him on some kind of skid thing or something, and so he could,
you know,
float and walk.
another thing that I noticed is how many of these people had messy personal lives. You know, we have this idea that in the past everybody married young, had kids, stayed married, and divorce was rare or even non-existent, and a lot of these people did not follow that path.
Yes, it's and probably maybe it's not the fact that it wasn't there, but it didn't surface. People didn't talk about it, or it wasn't well known. Hubbard was certainly one of those, because he was married and he had four children, I think, and decided he fell in love with a woman who had been a teacher in Cedar Falls. and Alice became his second wife, and she co-founded the artist colony there. But, you know, if you think about Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. I had no idea he had such a messy, him, but his father and his birth family.
Oh, yeah.
Give us a little rundown of all the scandal surrounding the Wrights.
Well, Wright was in Chicago and very successful. He had interns and assistants, and working with him, they were quite talented. But Mason City, commissioned him to do this tandem bank and hotel on the park. And by the way, they contacted him and knew about him because he was connected to Chautauqua speaking tours. He didn't do them, but some of his relatives did. And Unitarianism and that sort of thing, you know, was spread that way. But he came to Mason City, and he designed that tandem building along with another one. But then he fell in love with the wife of one of his clients in Chicago. And it was a long scandal, but finally it got revealed and it made the headlines in the newspaper nationwide. He was getting prominent, you know, enough to be a nice story. So Mason City had wanted to go ahead and hire him to develop a neighborhood of Prairie School houses, including the landscaping. And when that happened, then they withdrew or decided not to offer him that opportunity. So he went to Germany instead. But you know, the odd thing that happened then in that particular incident is that one of his finest assistants, you know, was hired to take on that neighborhood design in Mason City, and it's still there. It's one of the really great things to see if you go up there. You know, don't just go to the bank in the hotel, but go to the neighborhood. It's really remarkable. And that architect, that young architect, Burley Griffin, was going great guns on that. But then he won an international prize because Australia was wanting to build a new capital, Canberra. And they had a contest, worldwide contest, for someone to design it. And he won. And so it's such a huge thing. He has to leave for Australia. And so he starts that neighborhood, but other people have to take it over. The thing that is so weird to me is that I went to Australia to speak on various topics. And one of the topics I talked about was Frank Lloyd Wright. and they said, "Oh, we know all about Mason City."
Wow.
Because they knew all this history, and some of them had even, you know, come over to visit and were very excited about it. Isn't it surprising there are so many connections between all these people?
Yeah, it is. And Frank Lloyd Wright grew up in had a kind of a weird family situation growing up too. And his father ran off, or his parents got separated, divorced. He did not have a good relationship with his half siblings. And
Wow.
So there's a lot of things we don't really know about. One of the other kind of just details that I noticed is the number of people in this book who with Iowa connections in Iowa's past who were Jewish surprised me. I didn't even know that there were very many Jewish people in Iowa in the, you know, turn of the century, in early 1900s and during this time period.
Two of them are from Ottumwa. You know, I talk about a man named Carol Sachs, and his father owned the Sachs company there, which was a major clothing firm. And Carol Sachs went on to become a ship camouflage in World War One. And he grew up with Edna Ferber, who's also Jewish. And I talk about her meeting Harry Houdini in Appleton, Wisconsin. But then Harry Houdini also had connections to Marshalltown because one of his great friends was T. Nelson Downs, who was one of the world's greatest coin manipulators and magicians.
Like making coins appear out of nowhere.
Oh, heavens, yes. Yeah. Tons of them.
So are there any people that you didn't put in this book that you feel like maybe should have been in here?
Yeah, but I'm not going to tell you because I might have to do another book.
And
I really do have enough others that I've written about that I could easily come up with another 25 of quality.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And, you know, most of these happened not because I was really searching for Iowa connections, but because I was researching other things, other subjects. And I'd be reading along and suddenly the word Iowa would pop out of the text and I would track it down, you know.
It is kind of amazing how many Iowa connections you can find even when you're not looking for them.
Yes. Yeah. It's a lot like arrowheads, isn't it?
So do you collect arrowheads?
No, I do not.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you have a number of projects in the works.
I do. I'm still teaching online. I teach for Drake and College of William and Mary. And I'm also still publishing in a lot of ways. And I'm making video talks now. I've made about 18, and many of them are about some of these same subjects or parallel subjects. Yeah. Those are all on YouTube if you want to look for them.
Okay. So do you have your own YouTube channel?
Yes, I do.
And probably your own website.
Many of them, yes.
Many of them. Do you want to give any out for that you would want someone to go to?
You know, if you wanted to get to one of my blogs and if you want to get to all my films on YouTube, just type in my channel is called Camupedia. You know, the combination of camouflage and encyclopedia. But you have to make sure that you spell it Camoupedia, because there's another group of people who decided they would try to take my traffic away.
And
they call theirs Camoupedia. So, you know, you can just type in my last name and.
Which is Behrens, Behrens.
So. You got it.
All right.
You do that and I pop up on screen. Watch out.
Okay. All right. Well, Roy, thank you so much for being with us today. We always end with a quote, and I'm going to use with the quote that you closed your final chapter with in here from George Moore. A man travels the world in search of what he needs and returns home to find it.
Oh, thank you so very much. This is a good talk. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Well, I did too. And I'll look forward to seeing your next book. And this came from Ice Cube Press, who is one of, you know, our local independent presses. We like to support them. So thank you so much. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye.